Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, the Vatican asks Catholic bishops to delay a vote on how bishops might be held responsible for clerical sex abuse.
This is a dark day for survivors and Catholics. It's a real sign that even modest progress is being undercut by the Holy See.
Also, we remember Stan Lee, the Marvel Comics legend who died today at 95.
The main point is not to make your character perfect, because except for myself, there are very few perfect people in the world.
And on this Veterans Day, we explore the poetry of war.
I'm inside the Vietnam Veterans Memorial again, depending on the light to make a difference. I go down the 50,022 names, half expecting to find my own.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. There was some surprise news from the Catholic bishops who are meeting in Baltimore today. They say the Vatican asked them to delay voting on taking action on holding bishops accountable for protecting children in the clergy sex abuse crisis. Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley is at that meeting. He's also a leader of the Vatican's efforts to protect children from clergy abuse, and he tells the Boston Globe that he learned about the Vatican's request early this morning. Joining us to talk about this is John Allen, the editor of Crux Magazine, a news site that covers the Vatican and the Catholic Church. Welcome back to Radio Boston, John.
Always a thrill to go back to our org.
Also with us on the line, Anne Barrett Doyle. She's co-director of bishopaccountability.org. That's a website that documents the sex abuse crisis in the U.S. Thanks for being with us, Anne.
I'm delighted to be here, Deb. Hello, John.
Hi.
So, John, let's start with you. This is the biannual meeting of all 195 dioceses in the U.S. So why did the Vatican ask for this delay in voting when this meeting was supposed to take up how bishops might be held accountable for this wave of new sex abuse allegations that we heard about this summer?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. I mean, the bishops were supposed to adopt a new standard of conduct for themselves. I mean, we always knew that was going to require Vatican approval because in the Catholic system, there's only one superior of a bishop, and that's the Pope. But they were also expected to talk about how they were going to try to get to the bottom of the scandals surrounding former Cardinal Theodore McCarrick and many points beyond. Instead, Cardinal Daniel DiNardo of Galveston, Houston, who's the president of the conference, announced this morning that at the request of the Vatican's Conference of Bishops, they were supposed to stand down pending a meeting in February in Rome that the Pope has summoned for all the presidents of bishops' conferences all over the world. Now, we were given no explanation. The curious thing about this is the Pope's ambassador to the United States actually addressed the bishops this morning. He didn't say a word about it. It was DiNardo who relayed the Vatican's request. But what we were given to understand is that there were serious problems under church law with some of the things the bishops were supposed to vote on. They didn't finalize this action item until the 30th of October, just enough time for the Vatican to look it over. And apparently the decision was that if the bishops adopted this and it went to Rome, it would get shot down, which would obviously be bad optics for everyone. So they've been asked to wait for this this global summit in February.
So there is legitimacy to the argument that this really needed more time than could have been given if they had taken action today.
Well, certainly what we are hearing from a number of bishops today and also canon lawyers we've consulted at Crux is that the proposal that was put in front of the bishops contain a number of anomalies under what's known as canon law, which is the body of law for the Catholic Church, and that had it been adopted as written, now, of course, the bishops could have amended it during the course of the meeting, But had it been adopted as it was proposed, inevitably would lead to a veto from the Vatican, and obviously nobody wanted that. The curious part about this is why they are being asked to wait until February, at a time when I should note that the French bishops just last week brought out aggressive new policies, and the Italian bishops are unveiling their new policies on Thursday. It's a bit curious that other bishops' conference in other parts of the world are being encouraged to move ahead while the Americans are being told to wait.
Do we know what sort of anomalies would have caused these problems without getting into too much minutia here? I mean, is there something that was so egregious against canon law that they couldn't have amended it during this meeting in Baltimore?
I hope to God you'll be reading all about that on the Crux site tomorrow. right now, I have to say it's unclear. What we know is that the proposals contained a checklist of conduct and accountability for bishops, which apparently raised issues under the code. Because let's remember, under church law, a bishop is basically autonomous in his own domain. His only superior is the Pope. The bishop's conference has no authority over him. And if what this amounted to was a sort of claim of authority by the conference over bishops' conduct, that obviously would be something that would have to be squared with church law. Mm-hmm. But it's premature to speculate about what the issues are because, honest to God, we just don't know.
Hmm. Anne Barrett-Doyle, I want to bring you into this conversation. What's your take? You're in Baltimore for this meeting. What's your take on the Vatican's request and what happened?
Hi, Deb. Yes, I am in Baltimore. I am stunned. I really am stunned. I did not expect a lot to come out of the bishops' conference. I was not impressed by the proposals that were on the table. They seemed modest, inadequate to the demands for accountability, and yet they would have been something. It would have been good to hear the bishops talk about the need to correct brother bishops who are abusers or who enable abuse. Instead, even that modest bit of progress that may have come out of this meeting has been undercut by the Vatican. This is something that has happened before to the U.S. bishops. You know, in Dallas in 2002, to their credit, the U.S. bishops passed a one-strike-and-you're-out rule, and they also in their initial draft of essential norms, which is the canon law that's particular to the United States, they voted to implement a mandatory reporting policy. And also in their charter, they put a provision that would have a very strong lay advisory board. Both the lay advisory board and the mandatory reporting provision were revised quite significantly by the Vatican. And the ultimate result was a much weaker policy. So when the Vatican intervenes, and we've seen this in Ireland too in the 1990s, the rules get weaker. It's a very chilling reminder of something as an American Catholic that I don't often think about, which is that the Holy See has great power over our American bishops. They are essentially answering to the head of a foreign government. The Holy See is an independent sovereign state. As John said, it's ruled by canon law. And the priorities of canon law are not only justice, but the suppression of scandal and the preservation of the priesthood. And we see that kind of culture and priority in play here. It's not a good day for the Catholic Church in the United States. What a bad situation, I believe, has just gotten worse.
Now, you are there, and you had some specific recommendations for the bishops about what should happen in terms of perhaps extending some sort of protection or accountability measures to bishops that had been imposed on clergy and churches in the past. Tell us what your specific recommendations are and how you think they might help.
These are recommendations that we think the bishops here could still implement despite the Vatican directive to not vote on their other proposals. We were urging them to each bishop to release a list of credibly accused clergy, a really informative list, complete with assignment histories and description of the allegations and photographs. More and more bishops throughout the United States are doing that. I think the latest count was roughly, you know, between 50 and 60. That is the single most compassionate thing a bishop can do. The other thing we were urging them to do, and they can still do this, is to decide that they are no longer going to block statute of limitation reform. In fact, they could do just the opposite. They could endorse the reform of statute of limitations, including the retroactive windows. We know that there is no more powerful way for the names of perpetrators to become public and for institutions to be held accountable. Those are two things the bishops here could still do. And, of course, the individual bishops can just go ahead and do this in their own right.
John, likelihood of that?
Well, I mean, I think you would find a number of American bishops who would agree to some of the substance of that, probably with the exception of the rollback on the statute of limitations. I mean, the bishops in the states have always taken the argument that if you were going to roll back the statute of limitations, then you need to do that across the board. It can't just be targeted at the Catholic Church. They've argued, for example, in states where these proposals have come up, that it ought to be applied to, say, the public school system or publicly operated orphanages and so on. And states typically have not been willing to do that, which has left the bishops with the impression that this is not a genuine concern for child protection, but it's a punitive measure directed specifically at the church. But, you know, I think one thing Anne said, you know, she talked about the power that the Vatican has over the American bishops. I think another point we ought to make is that the American Catholic Church is just 6% of the global Catholic population. And things that will seem no-brainers to us just aren't from a global point of view. I mean, there was just a summit of bishops in Rome last month, something called a Synod of Bishops, which actually ended by failing to commit the Catholic Church to a zero-tolerance policy because of opposition to that that came from much of Africa, many parts of Asia, some parts of Latin America, and even some senior Italian members of the hierarchy. So the American bishops are not free agents when it comes to this. They are constrained by the Vatican, and they are also constrained by opinion in other parts of the Catholic world. And right now, that appears to be a bit of an uphill climb for them.
Well, in line with that, what about Boston Cardinal Sean O'Malley? He's, you know, the leader of the Vatican. He's an advisor to the Vatican on protecting children from clerical abuse. How does this reflect, do you think, on O'Malley? And we should say we do have a statement from O'Malley basically saying that the Cardinal will continue to vigorously advocate for holding bishops accountable and for greater transparency. Also said that this move does not change the Cardinal's commitment to zero tolerance of sexual abuse by clergy, and he thinks that the Church should have more time to deal with this in Rome in February. But just a reflection on Cardinal O'Malley. How do you think this plays out, John Allen?
Well, I mean, listen, Cardinal O'Malley has always been a change agent on the clerical sexual abuse issue. He has consistently fought for reforms, both in the United States and in Rome. And if Sean O'Malley by himself were setting Vatican policy, I think we'd be looking at a very different landscape. But he doesn't. There's a sort of game that's going on out there right now where a lot of people are wanting to blame this on the Vatican, like the blue meanies in the Roman Curia, which is the church's central governing bureaucracy. Well, the thing is, that will not cut it. Pope Francis has thoroughly neutered the Curia on his watch. There is one person and one person only making decisions in Rome, and that is Pope Francis. Ultimately, particularly once we see what happens in February, you know, if there are not dramatic reform measures adopted as a result of that meeting, I don't think we can evade asking the question of where is Pope Francis on this issue.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, Anne, I've read that you have also asked for the Massachusetts Attorney General to investigate clergy abuse here. Can you tell us why you're making that request, and have other states done that?
Certainly. Right now, Deb, in the wake of the Pennsylvania grand jury report, more than 15 attorneys general across the United States have said they're doing some kind of investigation or review of the Catholic diocese in their state. In Massachusetts, We have four dioceses. Boston's only one of them. And Springfield, Fall River, and Worcester have never been investigated. The crisis is the abuse allegations are largely sealed shut in those dioceses because the bishops there have taken advantage of the charitable immunity cap, and so victims have not been able to sue because they can't find plaintiff lawyers interested in those cases. And even here in the Boston Archdiocese, much is still hidden. You know, despite the fact, as John says, that Cardinal O'Malley has really voiced strong support for holding bishops accountable, he himself admits to keeping secret the names of 91 archdiocesan priests who've been accused of child sexual abuse. This is in a letter that's still on his website. This is a stunning, stunning fact. Because we're in Boston, we get calls from Boston survivors. We know some of the survivors who've reported to the archdiocese, and their perpetrators' names have not been made public by Cardinal O'Malley. He has some secrets of his own still. We're not saying he's breaking the law, but we're saying that there are many secrets here in Massachusetts, and the church here would be much healthier, we think, with more transparency. Attorney General Maura Healey could really help in that regard.
Okay. Ann Barrett Doyle, co-director of bishopaccountability.org, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And John Allen, editor of Crux Magazine, covering the Catholic Church and the Vatican. John, thanks to you as well.
Anytime.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Stan Lee, the so-called God of the Marvel Universe, died in Los Angeles today. He was 95 years old. Lee's creations ranged from Spider-Man to the Fantastic Four to the Incredible Hulk, X-Men, and the list goes on. In other words, he created some of the most iconic American superheroes of the 20th century. And last year, WBUR's Shira Springer spoke with Stan Lee when he was in Boston. So today, in his memory, we want to bring you that conversation again. Springer started by asking Lee how his career in comics began.
I had applied for a job at a publishing company because I wanted to be a writer, and I felt if you want to be a writer, the best place to work is at a place where they use written material. So I applied at this publishing company, and I found out the only opening they had was an assistant in the comic book department. So I figured, okay, I'll be an assistant in the comic book department. I never went out to say, I want to work in comics. It just happened that way. And somehow or other, I guess I wasn't good enough for anything else, but I stayed there all that time.
But when you started, though, I mean, was there did you feel a spark, a passion? Did it kind of feel like a good fit for you?
No, as a matter of fact, it didn't evoke any passion at all in the beginning because my publisher did not have any respect for his reader's intelligence. And all that he asked me to do was come up with stories that had a lot of running, jumping, fighting, shooting, and killing. He wasn't interested in characterization, in plotting, violence. He said, that's what the readers like. So for my first year or two in comics, I wrote these stories about people fighting each other. And it wasn't very satisfying, but it paid the rent. So one day I came home and I said to my wife, honey, I'm going to quit. It's ridiculous. I've got to get a better job somewhere else. And she gave me the wisest advice, the turning point in my life. She said, Stan, why don't you do a story the way you'd want to do it? You want to quit anyway, so if he fires you, so what? But at least you'll get it off your chest. So I wrote a story where it wasn't all fighting, but I tried to put some characterization, some reason why they were fighting, why they were the way they were. I tried to play up the characters rather than just the action. And I did the story, and I figured, okay, now I'll be fired. But it happened that that particular story sold pretty well. So I figured, well, I'll try it again. I wrote another story that way. And they started to sell well, and nobody yelled at me. And little by little, I started doing the stories the way I wanted to, and the books actually sold better that way. So that's how it all started for me, thanks to my wife.
I like you giving credit where credit's due to your wife. You know, it seems like you said you wanted the characters that you developed to have sort of a human side to them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you think makes for a compelling superhero, for them to have a certain amount of, to have some flaws?
Well, I think that's what makes any character. If you're reading a story, the first thing the writer has to do is make the reader care about the character. Then he or she has to make the reader believe in the character, and then make the reader want to see what's going to happen to the character. There you are. I've just given a life's experience in three sentences.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I want to go back to, the, you know, to care about the character, but also your characters have flaws in them. I mean, you know, Daredevil is a blind hero. The X-Men are mutants. I mean, in reality, they're real, but they're also flawed in a very human way.
Well, I hate to admit this, but I think almost everybody has flaws. The part, of course, that I hate to admit is the fact that I imagine if I looked long enough, I'd even find a flaw in me, as unbelievable as that may sound. But it's true. I mean, we all have things that we wish we could do better. I mean, I was always skinny. I always wished I could be more muscular, like a weightlifter. Some people are short, they wish they were tall. Some people are tall, they wish they were shorter. I mean, everybody sort of wishes for something. The main point is not to make your character perfect, because except for myself, there are very few perfect people in the world.
So we're gonna jump back in time. You served stateside in World War II, right?
Yeah.
How much of that conflict made its way into your comics?
Well, it influenced our writing a lot because Hitler became the greatest villain we could ever write about. And I didn't create him. Joe Simon and Jack Kirby created Captain America, although later on I wrote Captain America stories. And he was a great character during the war. He was the ultimate patriotic American character.
You also grew up during the Depression. What do you remember from that time, and how did that influence your work?
Well, I remember not having enough money. My parents never had enough money. My father had been a dress cutter in Europe.
And they were Romanian immigrants, correct? Mm,
yeah, from Romania. And he came over here and he had a tough time getting a job as a dress cutter. And most of my memories of him are just sitting in a room reading the want ads. And we didn't have that much dough, which is why I went to work when I was a teenager. I had to bring some money in. So my memories are not pleasant ones. They're memories of a man I felt sorry for because he wanted so badly to work and bring money in, and he couldn't get a job. And it was a tough time. And I was out there getting, this is before I went to work for the comics. I worked as a delivery boy for a company bringing lunches up to people at Radio City from the drugstore when they ordered lunch. I had I had one job. I was an usher at the Rivoli Theater in Times Square, and in those days the Rivoli Theater was very elegant. And one day Mrs. Roosevelt, the wife of the president, came into the theater to see the movie. And there were six ushers. Each of us had an aisle. And we all hoped we'd get Mrs. Roosevelt to come down our aisle. Sure enough, she came down my aisle. And I said, "This way, Mrs. President." I don't think I should have called her Mrs. President, but it was all I could think of at the moment. And I started walking with my head high and my shoulders back. And some terrible person was sitting on the aisle and had his legs stuck out. And I tripped on his aisle and I fell on my face. And the next thing I know, the wife of the President of the United States has me by the shoulders and is saying, "Are you hurt, young man? Here, let me help you up."
Oh, my gosh.
And I was so embarrassed, but she was so sweet about it. She's a very nice lady. And so there I was. I had taken the President's wife down the aisle, and she helped me to my feet after I tripped over somebody.
You and Eleanor Roosevelt. Wow. Let's jump to your most famous creation. Tell us about Spider-Man and how he came to be.
I had already done the Fantastic Four, and they were doing well. And my publisher said to me, "Why don't you come up with another superhero? Let's get a lot of them." I said, "Okay." So I went home and I thought and I thought, and I saw a fly crawling on the wall. Now, when you come up with a superhero, the most important thing is what superpower do you give him? So I thought, gee, wouldn't it be something if I could get a superhero who could stick to walls like an insect? So then the next thing you need is a name. So I thought, Insect Man? Nah. Mosquito Man? I went on and on down the thing, and then I came to Spider-Man, and somehow Spider-Man, it sounded dramatic. And then I thought, to make him different, I'll make him a teenager instead of an adult. And finally, I thought, I'll give him a lot of personal problems, because most everybody has personal problems, but nobody ever mentions them in the comics. So I'll give him problems. He doesn't have enough money, he has an aunt who's ill, things like that. So I brought that idea to my publisher, who said to me, "Stan, that is the worst idea I have ever heard." He said, "First of all, people hate spiders, so you can't call a hero Spider-Man. You want him to be a teenager? Stan, a teenager can only be a sidekick, not a superhero. And finally, you want him to have personal problems? He's a superhero. Superheroes don't have personal problems." So I couldn't do it. But I couldn't get Spider-Man out of my head. And we were about to kill a magazine. When you're killing a magazine, you put out the last issue and nobody cares what's in it. So just for fun, I put Spider-Man in that magazine. A month later, after the sales figures came in, my publisher came running into my office excitedly, and he said, Stan, do you remember that character of yours, Spider-Man, that we both liked so much?" He said, "Let's make him a series." And that's how Spidey was born.
And the rest is history, as they say.
And the rest is history.
Now, I know you're 94, but you're still working. So what's next for Stan Lee?
Probably some more cameos to do in the next few movies. I've gotten to love those cameos. And apparently the public gets a kick out of them, too. So I found a whole new way to entertain people. And it's not as hard as writing a comic book.
That's WBUR's Shira Springer speaking with Stan Lee in August of last year. Lee died in Los Angeles today. He was 95 years old. Stay with us. Coming up, when the battlefield is the muse, we'll talk about poetry and writing about war. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Today, as we mark the Veterans Day holiday, we want to take some time to consider writing about war. Although Walt Whitman concluded during the Civil War that, quote, "the real war will never get in the books," many writers try and arguably succeed in using words to work through what happens on the battlefield. Joining us for this conversation is Robert Pinsky's former Poet Laureate of the U.S. and the director of the Creative Writing Program at Boston University. Thanks for coming in.
Glad to be here.
Also with us by phone, Brian Turner. He served in the U.S. Army for 7 years. His poetry has been shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize. Brian, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, it's great to be here with you, Deborah and Robert.
Hi, Brian.
Hey, good to hear you.
And listeners, we want you to join in this conversation on this Veterans Day holiday. Do you have a favorite essay, poem, writing about war? Are you remembering someone this Veterans Day with a particular piece of writing? And if you are a veteran, has writing or poetry helped you process your experiences? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. And I guess I'm going to start with kind of a broad question, Robert mm-hmm. Pinsky, of finding beauty in tragedy, right, in poetry, beautiful words to describe the violence of war. How do you put those two things together?
Poetry offers a human scale. And war, beginning in this country with the Civil War, which was the first really recognized high technology war, the mass scale of the killing and the suffering, the impersonality of it, and the stupidity of it, the senselessness, all are in contrast to the idea of an art that is based on one human voice. So it's not just words. It's that single person. And when I think of the best-known poetry about war, one is very aware that the perspective is human. The scale is particular. So even if you're describing some of the most horrible things you can imagine, it isn't so much the beauty as the dignity, let's say, of one person speaking.
Right. So tell me, what are some of the most well-known writings about war that you think we should that should be considered essential writing when you're describing this senselessness of the human experience?
I'll name a prose work first. Ulysses Grant's memoirs give us the voice of someone who knows how to make sense out of war, as an expert at how much material has to be where, how the weather affects it, how the roads affect it, and how human personality affects it. And at the same time, he has a lot of insight into personalities. So you know which general is good but slow, which one is fast but a little crazy. And his grief for the deaths and his unforgettable contempt and anger at Nathan Forrest and the slaughter at Pillow Hill. It's a good counterpart to the poetry of Whitman about the war. And it anticipates the war that one of the things they say about the First World War is it never ended. Mm-hmm. He anticipates that never-ending First World War, which can't be made sense of and which kept seeming to keep going of its own weight without anyone willing it to keep going. And in that sense, he anticipates the American voice of Whitman, but also the great World War I poets who died in that war, like Wilfred Owen. Sassoon, Owen's, in a way, his mentor, didn't die in the war. But those, and in my own generation, Yusuf Komunyakov, who's a veteran of Vietnam, wrote a poem called Facing It that a lot of people know and love.
Right. Well, I'm wondering if we maybe go back first instead of going to your generation. Maybe we go back to World War I first.
Yes.
And the Wilfred Owen poem "Dulce et Decorum Est," which is considered one of the famous
yes.
poems about war. I'm wondering if you could read a little bit of that.
Sure. Dulce et decorum est. Bent double like old beggars under sacks, knock-kneed. Coughing like hags, we cursed through sludge till on the haunting flares we turned our backs and toward our distant rest began to trudge. Men marched asleep. Many had lost their boots, but limped on, bloodshod. All went lame, all blind, drunk with fatigue, deaf even to the hoots of tired, outstripped 5-9s that dropped behind. Gas! Gas, quick boys, an ecstasy of fumbling, fitting the clumsy helmets just in time. But someone still was yelling out and stumbling and floundering like a man in fire or lime. Dim through the misty panes and thick green light as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams, before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. if in sonic smothering dreams you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, his hanging face, like a devil sick of sin, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from the froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not talk with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory. The old lie, dulce et decorum est, pro patria mori. Hmm. Those last words in Latin are from the Latin poet Horace, and in a way it's no fair on Horace. If you actually read that Horace ode, Horace, unlike poets like poor Rupert Brooke, who we all deride and deplore because he wrote nationalistic poems about that war, Horace, in the context of what he's saying how arbitrary it all is. It's a poem. If you read the poem in David Ferry's or Robert Hass's translation, Horace is closer to Wilfred Owen than it seems. I think Wilfred Owen is thinking more of kind of jingoistic, nationalistic, chauvinist, often ruling class propaganda about the glory of war. Mm. And it's not a poem one forgets.
Hmm. I want to bring Brian Turner into the conversation a bit. Brian, do you remember this poem by Wilfred Owen? You remember the first time you heard it and how it may have affected you?
I think I did in high school. Hmm. I was in AP English class with Mrs. Grupa's AP English class, I believe. But
I guess you remember.
Yeah, over the years, it's stuck with me and sort of become more and more layered. I guess to add to some of what Robert's saying there, you know, for me, in that point when it says, as under a green sea, I saw him drowning. And then earlier, it says, a little bit later, it says, if in some smothering dreams you too could pace behind the... That rhetorical move, if in some smothering dreams you too... As if, you know, Wilfred knows that we aren't there. You know, and there's that distance that's recognized. And yet, through language, I feel like he's pulled us very close to... Our boots aren't quite in the mud, but I feel very close to this moment. It's as close as I can come to recognizing something my great-grandfather might have witnessed as he was gassed in France. And it took years for the gas to kill him, but in 1932 it finally did.
Mm-hmm. Brian, I want to ask you about why you've decided to use poetry to describe war. Is it, like Robert Pinsky says, trying to make sense of some of the senselessness of war and using language to do that? But before I do, I want to make sure I remind our listeners that you are invited to join this conversation and share with us your favorite writings about war. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So, Brian Turner, why? Why use poetry to describe what happens on the battlefield?
For me, I think initially I wrote poems while I was a sergeant in Iraq, and I wrote them in my notebooks. And initially I started off just writing journal entries, and then a couple of lines of a poem would appear, and I'd recognize it. I'd written poetry for years before that. And then I put it into another notebook and continued to work on them. I couldn't have answered that question, I don't think, if you'd asked me at the time. But looking back, I think it's because I couldn't see a narrative or a through line to the whole thing. I couldn't see the sort of prosaic, discursive sort of wandering through a set of ideas. It seemed very disparate sort of moments would happen, and in between that was the through line was sort of boredom and emptiness, and then some crazy event would happen, or 24 hours of an event, or 30 seconds of it, and then back to boredom again. And so poetry seemed... Because I wasn't high up the food chain. I wasn't a general or something like that who could see, you know, the large scale movements on a map of the political events that were taking place. I was deep down inside of a war, just in one period of a war, and poetry seemed a vehicle that helped me to say what couldn't be said any other way.
Mm. You also have a poem called Eulogy about one of your fellow soldiers who died in Iraq. Just tell us a little bit about this poem.
Well, I think the poem you know, it does the work itself, but maybe outside of the poem. When I came home, this was the one. I was invited to go to Germany at one point to read, and they flew me from California there, and they just wanted me to read one poem. And so it had to be this one.
Hmm.
And part of the reason for that was that when my unit came back from Iraq, we were out on a parade field, and the colonel gave a speech at one point, and during his speech, he listed the names of those who did not come back with us. And I was listening to that list of names, and then Private Miller's didn't appear. And it seemed like he'd been erased. And so it became a very kind of political thing for me. I felt like there was an American citizen who deserved to have his name spoken among the dead, you know. And
the reason it wasn't included?
Sure. Eulogy. It happens on a Monday at 11:20 a.m. as tower guards eat sandwiches and seagulls drift by on the Tigris River. Prisoners tilt their heads to the west, though burlap sacks and duct tape blind them. The sound reverberates down concertina coils the way piano wire thrums when given slack, and it happens like this on a blue day of sun when Private Miller pulls the trigger to take brass and fire into his mouth. The sound lifts the birds up off the water. A mongoose pauses under the orange trees, and nothing can stop it now. No matter what blur of motion surrounds him, no matter what voices crackle over the radio in static confusion, because if only for this moment the earth is stilled, and Private Miller has found what low hush there is down in the eucalyptus shade there by the river.
Hmm. That's very beautiful, Brian. Very beautiful.
Well, you know, part of the reason I stopped reading it for a time because it felt like, as I continued to read, I had to bring Private Miller back to life and then kind of kill him again every time I read the poem. And after a couple of years, I got really so tired of that whole process, and it just seemed unhealthy, you know. So I stopped reading that poem. And then I was in Broward County, and I was at a veterans event on a day like today or yesterday, and the suicide rate was brought up during that time. Mm-hmm. It astounded me. And I started doing the math on it and thinking about the losses of the wars that we've been a part of during all of our lifetimes. And it seems that when we're talking about, you know, oftentimes wars are given by historians, they're given these tombstones with the number of dead on them and when the war was born and when it finished, you know, the year that the war was over. But the wars, all the historians are wrong, and the wars outlive the books that they're put in.
I want to bring some callers into the conversation before we run out of time. Brian is calling from Hyde Park. Brian, you're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to suggest the book Fear by Gabriel Chevalier, which was published in French about World War One. It's an autobiographical novel that was written, finished before World War Two, but then the author was too depressed to actually publish it. It's only recently been available, and it's just a striking and horrible confirmation of war as fought by lions and led by donkeys, which is how I feel about most conflicts, including Vietnam, where my father was killed. He was an officer, but he identified with the donkeys.
So the book Fear, Brian, thanks so much for that recommendation. Are you familiar with that? Robert Pinsky? No. Brian Turner, are you familiar with that?
No. I was going to suggest maybe Hassan Blasim, the corpse exhibition. And, you know, we're getting... I'm grateful for Brian's suggestion. I'm going to read that book. But one of the things from the war in Iraq and Afghanistan now, these wars, we're beginning to get children who lived through them, you know, and are writing in Arabic or other languages, and they're being translated now. We can start getting voices from the war that know much more about the war than I can speak to.
I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Michael is calling from Somerville. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, my name is Michael. I heard someone mention that they heard that piece they were talking about in an AP English class, and I heard a poem. It's called "The Diameter of the Bomb." It's by an Israeli poet named, I'm going to mispronounce his name, but Yehuda Amachi.
Amachai.
Amazing how
Amachai. Robert Pinsky knows this.
it's a beautiful poem.
It's amazing how those poems stay with us years after we read them, you know, at a glance in English class. And I don't know anyone that's ever served, and I've never served myself, but the way they can put us into conflict and make us feel like we've really experienced it years later, it's amazing.
Well, so Michael,
say that. Thanks.
Michael, I wonder what message do you think you took from that that still resonates with you that made you remember it?
Well, the thing is the poem was about it was about war, and it was about how the diameter of the bomb impacts people globally. It doesn't just impact the people that are directly involved in the conflict. One of the lines is, you know, the person mourning the death of the girl on a distant land across the ocean. And I think any time there's something bad that happens in the world, whether it's a shooting or if it's just maybe a mean comment someone makes to another person, that gets transferred to another person, and that gets transferred to another person, and one bad thing can impact everyone in the world. You know, on the flip side, one good thing can impact everyone in the world. It's amazing how, like it says in the poem, the diameter of the bomb was 7 meters. It's, you know, its effective range, 7 meters. But it ends up impacting everyone. And then the last line, and most of all, the orphans whose cries go all the way up to heaven, making a circle with no end and no God. Mm. And it's, you know, one bad act is, you know, infinite. It propagates infinitely. One good thing can propagate infinitely. And I just love that.
All right. Thanks so much for your call. I'm wondering, Brian Turner, can we ask you, give us a work that you recommend on this Veterans Day for folks to reflect?
Well, if I follow the last caller's his impulse there, then I would suggest, because oftentimes we look to writers who are inside wars, like Michael Hare and Dispatches, for example, beautiful book. But I'd also recommend something like Siobhan Fallon, who's a spouse of a military service member. She wrote a novel called You Know When the Men Are Gone. And there's a new wave of writers that are coming now that are connected to military service in different ways, and we have a lot to learn from them. They've been kind of in silence for decades, as the veterans have spoken.
Well, that makes a perfect segue into someone who's waiting to get in on this conversation and weigh in a bit. Tom Lasser was in the Army for 6 years, and he leads a veterans writing workshop at Salem State University. Tom, I'm wondering, what work or works do you put on your list of writing about war?
Sure. Well, thank you for having me. Mm. In the last year, I really recommend Company K by William March. I feel that he wrote sort of these little vignettes from the perspective of every person in this one company in World War I. And it's a fantastic book that we have been covering over the last year, since it is the 100-year anniversary of Armistice Day. And what we really find in this work is that there are some segments that could have happened in Iraq or Afghanistan, and so much commonality, even though there's 100 years between us.
And tell us why, you know, Brian mentioned sort of folks with firsthand experience really joining in and putting their voices out there in terms of writing about war. Is that why you started this workshop? And what do you hope to achieve with this?
Well, for me personally, I had a pretty traumatic deployment to Afghanistan. And I began to use writing as a way of making sense of my experiences. But even deeper than that, I started to find that when I was talking to other people, the relationships that were developing were much more meaningful, whether it was a Vietnam veteran or a spouse of a veteran or even a civilian. I found that really at the core of war is, for the person, is trauma. And I think that on some deeply human level, we can all somehow connect to trauma. And creating this group and opening it to not just veterans but civilians allows us to really struggle with that and open a real dialogue where we can find more commonality that is outside just, say, one veteran experience.
Robert Pinsky, last word goes to you in our final minute here. Do you think the writing about war, and perhaps, if you agree with Tom, including trauma, has made the writing change?
I think that the scale of war changed everybody's imagination. Mm. The heroic idea of war as knightly was dealt a tremendous blow by our Civil War, and then in a kind of fatal blow by the First World War. And our wars nowadays involve so many civilians. The idea of war as a duel between knightly classes is gone by the civilian casualties. When I listened to Brian read his poem, I listened to Tom talking, I thought of the great story in today's Boston Globe. The young man who sacrificed himself in the First World War recalled his two grandfathers Civil War.
Robert Pinsky, thanks so much. Brian Turner, Tom Lasser, thanks to you as well. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.